Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. Before we begin today's show, we want to let you know that parts of it will be disturbing. Three U.S. officials told Axios that the Biden administration is convinced Iran is going to attack Israel in retaliation for the assassination of Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran earlier this week and is preparing to counter it. On today's show, we will also discuss a U.N. report that says Palestinians detained by Israel since October 7th have been sexually abused and tortured. And then later in the show, we will get the latest on the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Joining us is Oren Zeev, a photographer and reporter for Local Call and Plus 972 magazine, an independent online magazine run by Palestinian and Israeli journalists. Oren Zeev's latest piece is called A Riot for Impunity, shows Israel's proud embrace of its crimes. Far-right protesters, soldiers, and MKs rallied for guards suspected of raping a Palestinian detainee. Once fringe, they are now the public face of the state. Hi, Oren. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, I first want to ask you about the alarming developments of the past couple of days. This week's assassinations of top Hezbollah commander Fayyad Shukr in Beirut and Hamas's political leader Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran has raised so many alarms about the possibility of an expanded regional war. I mentioned the piece that Axios has out, saying that three U.S. officials say Biden's convinced Iran will attack Israel in retaliation and is preparing to counter it. You're in Jerusalem. What does the situation look like where you are?
I'm currently
in Haifa, in the northern city of Haifa, one of the places that people fear might be one of the targets, especially from an attack from Lebanon. I spoke to many people since the assassinations. On one hand, some of the people in the Israeli public, which has moved to the right over the past few years, they are happy with the assassination. They feel it's kind of a revenge for the October 7 event for the attack from Lebanon, killing 12 children in Madrid, something they occupied Golan a week ago. But in general, there's also a big sense of fear. People understand.
Oren, I'm sorry. It's hard to hear you. You're going in and out. I'm not sure if that's on your end. You're clear, and then we can't hear you very well.
Can you hear me better now?
Now you sound very, very good.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry about that. So in some of the public, for sure, the extreme right and the right wing is happy for the revenge. But other people are concerned for their own safety, for attack that might come from a few fronts, and also, of course, for the hostages, because Ismail Haniyeh, although he was not a loved figure, of course, in the Israeli public, was the person the negotiation was going on with. And people, especially the families of hostages and the supporters that have been protesting in the streets of Israel for 300 days, are worried that this assassination will bring an end, or practically brought an end, at least for now, for the negotiation for a hostage deal and a ceasefire. So people are worried for the safety of the hostages.
So since you brought up the hostages, what does this mean then for the hostages, given that Ismail Haniyeh was Hamas's top negotiator? And then we'll talk about what this will mean for a ceasefire.
It's hard to say, but people have the feeling that every time that the deal is almost signed, so there's reports and sources saying that there's some development, Netanyahu finds the way to sabotage it for his political benefit, because he wants to survive, because he understands that if a deal comes to the table, his extreme right-wing government might fall. Ben-Gvir and Smotrich and other extreme figures in his government said they're opposing a deal. And any release of Palestinian political prisoners and stopping the war and getting the army out of Gaza. So people here in Israel feel, many people at least, not everyone of course, feel that Netanyahu is acting to survive politically and is not so interested, for sure not regarding the life of Palestinians, but also not regarding the life of the Israeli hostages held in Gaza for over 300 days.
In fact, today, a Haaretz headline says, Haniyeh's assassination made it clear Israeli hostages are not at the top of Netanyahu's agenda. What does this mean for a ceasefire? The Hill had a piece about a phone call between Netanyahu, President Biden, and Vice President Harris. And President Biden said, quote, I had a very direct meeting with the prime minister. We have the basis for a ceasefire. They should move on it, and they should move on it now. So what does this mean for a potential ceasefire?
I think it makes it harder and more far, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And of course, first of all, Palestinians in Gaza are paying the price of it, including Palestinian journalists that are being killed all the time. I think in the end of the day, the basic elements of a ceasefire, as we learned from different reports and sources, were already agreed around November and then in December and, you know, and again and again, I mean, after the first ceasefire in November. And it seems that Netanyahu is not willing to pay the political price to do it. It's very clear that in a ceasefire, Palestinian prisoners will be released. It's very clear that Israel will have to allow Palestinians to go back to center and northern Gaza. And it's very clear that the army will have to withdraw from the Gaza Strip. But, and this is all public information and something that has been discussed many times, but it seems Netanyahu is now the obstacle. Now, a second thing is that this assassination served Netanyahu for his political base to show, you know, they're making some revenge, but it also served the military and the security establishment because, you know, internally in Israel, they were under a lot of criticism for their failure on October 7th, the intelligence failure, the military failure. And this assassination kind of showed that they still have the ability to hit and to target, even in Tehran, that Israel haven't done that for years, and in Lebanon. And this is why I think in this situation, there was a correlation between the interests of the military establishment in Israel and Netanyahu's interests. And this is why it happened on the long term, especially if a regional war starts. But even if not, if just we have a few days of exchange of rockets, in the end of the day, the Israeli public will also pay a price for those actions. Mm.
Oren Ziv is a reporter for Local Call and Plus 972 magazine. He's joining us from Haifa. He'll be with us for 15 more minutes. So if you have any questions for Oren about what is happening on the ground in Israel and about the alarming developments of the last couple of days, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Before we get to your piece about what is happening to Palestinian prisoners, given that you have been reporting on the horrific unfolding events in Gaza, Oren, how long do you think this can last? I mean, we've been asking this for months.
I think it's a question that all of us were asking. After the October 7 attack, it was clear, unfortunately, that Israel will go for a very harsh and revenge war. In 2014, the war lasted 52 days, and we were hoping it won't last more. But with the time, it seems, you know, also internationally, of course, there's the international court case and a lot of pressure. But it seems that, and at the end of the day, nobody is stopping Netanyahu and the Israeli government from doing it. Nothing. We've been publishing on Plus 972 magazine, but also on other outlets, horrific investigations from Gaza, from killing from the sky, killings with AI led programs. We published about the behavior of soldiers on the ground, looting, stealing, shooting without any limitations. But all this, and the protests and all the pressure doesn't stop it. So it's very hard to say how long can it go. I think for Netanyahu and for sure for his extreme right government, this is a reality. This is their dream. They want it to continue like that. And not only in order to survive, but because even Netanyahu refused to talk. And this we're hearing from sources in the Israeli military establishment. Netanyahu refuses to talk about the day after. He refuses to talk about the option that the Palestinian Authority or any other authority will rule in Gaza. On the other hand, he's also not confirming that Israel will fully control it civil-wise and, you know, settlements like the far-right ministers are demanding. So in this situation, you can use horrific force, killing, massacre, but still you cannot achieve anything. We've seen Israel has been on this war for months, and even the official targets or aim of the war, which was bringing the back the hostages and eliminating Hamas, are not really achieved. And this is, I'm talking from an Israeli internal perspective. So it's not clear, I think, at least part of the public understand that hostages can be brought alive only in a deal. And this is why we've seen mass protests in Israel, which are not kind of the classical anti-war protests we've seen around the world. But people understand that in order to do a hostages deal, you have to have a ceasefire and end the war. And they're saying it, the families of the hostages, at least most of them, and the people, the tens of thousands going to the streets of them, are saying, yes, we should stop the war completely in order to bring back the hostages. But unfortunately, it doesn't seem the government care about that.
I was looking at the incredible photos on your Instagram page of hostage families protesting, being arrested. You also have, on July 1st, there was a huge gathering in Tel Aviv. Thousands of left-wing activists took part in a conference called to stop the war, to reach a deal, to make peace. Are you finding that opinion on this is changing at all, or do the majority of Israelis still support the assault on Gaza?
So unfortunately, yes, the vast majority of the public support the assault on Gaza. I think with the time, and because the government is neglecting the hostages issue, and in the end of the day, it's Israeli citizens kidnapped from the beds, from their houses, most of them not soldiers, and the country has responsibility to bring them back. And the fact the country is not doing that made many people realize that they should go out to the street and demonstrate for that. And the public opinion has shifted a bit. We saw this gathering calling to end the war with thousands of people, Palestinian citizens of Israel and Jewish left-wing activists. And you had there also victims of the October 7 attack, even one hostage that was released, and families that lost their beloved ones in October. And they were calling to end the war. They were calling to bring back the hostages, but even more important, they were calling to promote or to work for a sustainable solution. I think many people understand, I think not enough, but some people understand that this war and the October 7 attack should teach us that there has to be a diplomatic or political solution. Unfortunately, the far right and the right and the mainstream Israelis think that the October 7 failure should lead to more fences and more force and more army forces, instead of understanding that even for Israelis, security can be brought only in a political solution and justice. But I think also from October, the Israeli police and the Israeli legal systems have been doing everything to prevent demonstrations, especially when we're talking about Palestinian citizens of Israel and radical left-wing activists that were protesting specifically against the war. So they forbid demonstration. They were arresting people, trialing them even for social media posts, checking signs in the entrance of demonstration, dispersing demonstrations after a few minutes, even if it's small gatherings, and basically creating a situation that people will be afraid to protest.
We're speaking with Oren Zeev, a photographer and reporter for Local Call and Plus 972 magazine, an independent online magazine run by Palestinian and Israeli journalists. Let's now talk about your piece, A Riot for Impunity Shows Israel's Proud Embrace of Its Crimes. And this is the part of the show that's going to be disturbing. Far-right protesters, soldiers, and MKs rallied for guards suspected of raping a Palestinian detainee. Once Fringe reports Oren, they are now the public face of the state. So just to give some context here, a new report by the UN Human Rights Office found at least 53 Palestinian detainees have died in Israeli custody since October 7th. The UN found Palestinian prisoners have faced multiple forms of torture, including waterboarding, sleep deprivation, starvation, electric shocks, and the release of threatening dogs. The UN says most of the Palestinian men, women, children, doctors, journalists, and human rights defenders jailed by Israel are being held without charge or trial in deplorable conditions. You all at Plus 972 have done so many investigations showing that soldiers have been given immunity to loot, vandalize, shoot, and kill at will with the knowledge of their commanders on the ground. So can you first tell us more about your reporting and then what the UN found about Palestinian detainees being held in Israeli custody?
Yes, yeah, so on one hand, we talk to sources in the military, soldiers on the ground. We've done a few investigations, and the latest we did found that on the ground, soldiers are just giving a free hand to open fire, even if there's no any real reason. They can shoot without limit. They can target houses. They get permission almost automatically to anything. They burn houses systematically as a revenge. They loot, they steal, and all this with the knowledge and of the commanders on the ground, and also the higher commanders, and in general, the feeling among the army is that, you know, revenge is allowed. Everything is allowed. Nobody's going to be trialed, of course, or punished if they do something that is illegal according to international law, even according to internal army orders. So this is kind of the background. And regarding the story, and by that we can get to the UN report also later, the latest story. So since the beginning of the war, Israel has opened a prison or kind of a detention facility in Sdeit Haiman, the army base, which is important to say, in southern Israel, which is not a proper prison and is not run by the prison authorities like other prison, but is run by the army. For the Palestinians, they have arrested in Gaza. Some of them are fighters. Some of them are suspected to be part of Hamas. And some of them are civilians, journalists, and other people who were arrested because the place they were spotted or because of other reasons. And from what we heard from Palestinians who were released from there, and also from a lawyer that was there, that it's a horrific conditions. People are blindfolded and handcuffed with plastic handcuffs almost 24 hours a day. There's prevention of sleep, food, water, sanitation facilities. It's basically a torture camp. And it's important to say that, you know, of course, torture is illegal according to international law for any reason, but not like in other places. The torture is not done in order to investigate and to get some information from them, at least. And it's not happening in the investigation room. The torture is kind of the place itself. That's the main reason. That's the daily routine. It's not a specific torture against one person or another to try to make him collaborate or admit in something, which is, of course, also illegal. But the torture is the daily routine there. And, of course, soldier beating people, humiliating them, and also, as we learn, also sexually harassing or attacking them, even up to rape. And on Monday, the military, the Israeli military police, detained 10 soldiers that were serving as reservists in a unit guarding the prisoners from Gaza in the Sdeit Haiman base. They detained them, and this is automatically, it's immediately caused a lot of anger among MKs, as you said, ministers, and also right-wing activists. It's important to say that from their perspective, I can understand why they're angry, because, of course, I don't agree with them, but because since the beginning of the war, there has been a feeling in the Israeli public, but especially among soldiers, that there is full impunity. We heard it from statements on October from the prime minister, from the ministers, that, you know, speaking about revenge, speaking about there's no uninvolved, there's no innocent people in Gaza, that everybody supports Hamas, everybody was celebrating. And, you know, this came from high up till the last soldier. And till now, we haven't seen many, despite the evidence, even people filming themselves on social media and publishing it, despite hundreds of thousands of tens of thousands of cases and incidents that Palestinians testified about, that, like the report of the UN, like investigation we did, despite all those evidence, we have barely saw cases the military police arrested people or even investigated a case. Therefore, there was a lot of anger from the right. They came to the Tayman army base, broke in. Later, when they understood, and this was led by member of the Knesset, member of the Israeli parliament. Later, they came to another base in center Israel, Beit Lid, where the military court and detention facility for soldiers is located. They protest there with also members of the government, of the coalition. And at some point, they broke into the facility, into the court. There were also presence of armed men with masks, with army uniform, with military weapon, probably friends or colleagues of the people who were detained. And basically, they were demanding their release. They were demanding to put in jail the general military attorney that ordered or was, you know, managing this investigation. And there were saying basically that soldiers should have full impunity, that no soldier should be arrested. They were claiming this is false accusation because a Palestinian testified, so they don't believe it. And they also attacked media crews at the scene. I was there at night. There was some army forces there. There was very little police. As we can understand from different sources, it seems the police that is under the control of Minister Ben-Gvir, extreme right, right-wing Ben-Gvir, just didn't act, didn't come to support the army and to prevent breaking into those two bases. And it's important to understand, in Israel, the security is very tight. As a citizen, you cannot just walk, of course, to a military base. You might be shot if you're a Palestinian. And we've seen in much, much smaller and non-violent peaceful demonstrations of 50 or 60 people in Haifa and other cities, that the police comes in huge forces with water cannons, with horses, arresting people for just standing off on the sidewalk and calling for a ceasefire, calling to end what's going on in Gaza, maybe trying to raise a Palestinian flag, which became de facto not illegal in inside Israel since October. And we've seen this police force also used against mainstream protesters, against the government, and for the hostages, with all their force. And there, where people are breaking into army base, where soldiers with automatic rifles and uniform are protesting against the army, we have seen no action. Also, since then, the police didn't arrest one single person for those riots.
Oren, I know we have to let you go. Before we do, I have one more question for you, and thank you for telling us about this. Thank you for your reporting on this. How far are you from Gaza right now?
I would say around 200 kilometers.
Okay. Can you tell us in time? Like if you drove? What? If you drove, how long would it take?
Yeah, less like 2 hours or 2 hours.
2 hours.
20 minutes.
Have you tried to get into Gaza?
So, it's a good question. So, even before the war, Israeli journalists were not allowed, and also international journalists can enter only with permission of the Israeli government. Now, since the war, Gaza has completely been blocked for journalists. The only way to get in as an Israeli or foreign journalist is to go embedded with the Israeli army, which means going on a tour with a limited time, limited location. Of course, you cannot meet or see Palestinians. And they, of course, control what you see and what you can report. So I personally prefer to skip that. Of course, inside Gaza, you have many Palestinian journalists the ones who survived and are still reporting, which are doing an amazing work in unbearable conditions that me as a journalist cannot even imagine. And of course, I'm sending my solidarity to them. And we have to be based on their reports and speaking to people who went out and speaking on the phone, Zoom, or WhatsApp with other people. But that's a major problem because even if you agree to go on embed with the Israeli, I mean, this cannot be the only source of information. It can be one source of information out of many. Those embed tours usually go to tunnels or to other things the military found and wants to show to the media, but you cannot, of course, go there freely and investigate yourself. And this is a problem. It's part of the policy in general, specifically towards the Israeli public, that the Israeli mainstream media is also not showing what's going on in Gaza, as you see in the US and in other countries in Europe or around the world. But yeah, it's been a major problem. There's at 972, we have writers, reporters, and photographers on the ground in Gaza. Some of them had to leave to save their life. Others are still reporting in very hard conditions without electricity, a stable place to live, and food and water. And they're doing really amazing work in really maybe the hardest conditions journalists can face, while also trying to take care of themselves and their families.
Well, Oren, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for your reporting. Oren Zeev is a photographer and reporter for Local Call and Plus 972 magazine, an independent online magazine run by Palestinian and Israeli journalists. Thank you, Oren.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Coming up after a break, we will talk about the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Gaza. We will also talk about the Biden administration's Gaza policy. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Gaza, the Biden administration's Gaza policy, and how Gaza will impact the presidential election. I just got a breaking news alert, and we knew this was going to happen, but it is official. Vice President Kamala Harris is now the Democratic nominee for president. A new Jacobin investigation takes a deep dive into President Biden's early political career and how that explains his unconditional support for Israel. Branko Marchetich is Jacobin's staff writer and the author of Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. He wrote a piece called How Joe Biden Became a Steadfast Israel Defender. Hi, Branko. Thank you for joining us again.
Hey, thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Samer Badawi, a Palestinian writer and contributor to Plus 972, an independent online magazine run by Palestinian and Israeli journalists. Hi, Samer. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Thanks, Rose. Good to be here.
Well, great to have you. So we just spoke with your colleague, Samer Oren Zeev, who's a reporter and photographer at Plus 972, about the events of the past couple of days, the assassination of top Hezbollah commander Fuad Shukr in Beirut and Hamas's political leader Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran. This has raised so many alarms about the possibility of an expanded regional war. What are your thoughts on this?
Thanks, Malia. Thanks, Rose. I think it was very interesting the way you asked Oren toward the end of the last segment about the distance standing between him and Gaza. And I took the liberty of actually looking up to confirm this. But in point of fact, I think what many people forget about the region is that all of these cities are very close to each other. Beirut is a little over 200 kilometers from Gaza City. Cairo is not that much farther. It's about 350. Amman similarly is within a day's drive. And I think what's happening right now in all of these places where I and many other Palestinians, have family, friends, colleagues, is that everyone is sitting and waiting, helplessly with no sense of agency over what is going to happen next. I was speaking to someone in Haifa yesterday, actually a colleague of ours, Oren's and mine, and she said people are going about their daily business, especially the Palestinian residents of Haifa. But, you know, what people who are old enough to recall remember very well is in 1991 when Saddam Hussein was firing Scud missiles at Tel Aviv, and, you know, Jewish Israelis were receiving gas masks and many Palestinians were not. And, you know, there's a great fear there about what this will mean and the implications for Palestinians there. But the situation is the same in Beirut and certainly in Gaza. One of the issues that you know has come to the fore from the very beginning of this 10-month genocide is that we don't know who the reliable sources are in Gaza. And part of the reason we don't know that is because the Israelis have done such a good job of calling into question each and every source. And, you know, for me, the as a journalist, I know people on the ground and I can talk to them and I can sort of follow them on Twitter. But, you know, I can tell you that 2 days ago when Haniyeh was killed, more people were mourning the death of Ismail Al-Ghoul, the 27-year-old Al Jazeera reporter who was literally beheaded by an Israeli airstrike, than they were Ismail Haniyeh. And what this points to is a long-running theme in Gaza and one that you'll see in war zones throughout the world, which is that people on the ground, especially the 9 and 10 of Palestinians in Gaza who are now displaced and have nowhere to live, are more concerned about day-to-day survival than they are the geopolitics of the region. And so I think part of our role as reporters, and I know you've done such a tremendous job of this, Rose, is to continue surfacing that reality for the individual people suffering under this genocidal war. Mm.
And we're going to talk about this in a minute. More than 150 journalists have been killed in Gaza. We're going to talk about that in just a minute. But I also want you to jump in here, Bronco, and let us know what your thoughts are about this moment. I mean, the New York Times has a piece today. Here's the headline: Netanyahu defiant appears to have gone rogue, risking a regional war. This is by Stephen Erlanger. As the Biden administration and its allies try to secure an elusive ceasefire, Israel appears to have gone rogue. Netanyahu came to Washington last week to give a defiant speech. Despite international condemnation, he vowed to continue the war in Gaza and the West Bank, where Israel is killing and imprisoning scores of Palestinians each week without any clear idea of its end game. So what are your thoughts, Bronco? So many people are so concerned about what is to come in the region.
Well, I would say that Israel has gone rogue. But it went rogue long before this. I mean, Israel, what has done over the course of this war is beyond anything that when we think of kind of villainous rogue states like North Korea, for instance, or even Iraq under Saddam Hussein. It's so much beyond that. I mean, they've killed a record number of UN workers. They have accused the United Nations of being in league with Hamas and anti-Semitic. They've killed a record number of journalists. And that's before we even get to the scale of human slaughter, just completely indiscriminate destruction that has gone on in Gaza. In terms of this particular moment, it's a very concerning one. I'm sure, like a lot of people, waiting with bated breath to see what exactly is going to happen, what Iran, how they're going to retaliate, what the Israeli response to that will be, what the U.S. response will be to that response. You know, we are I think maybe the third or fourth time, at least in the course of the last 9-10 months in this war, on the verge of this exploding into a regional conflagration. And saying that could be a disaster, not just for the people that live there, but also for the United States, which will, I think, inevitably get dragged into whatever conflict ends up erupting over there. And the question is, why? You know, why is it that we are here? And you have to say it's because of the blank check, the unconditional support that Biden has pledged to Netanyahu from the beginning of this conflict, which means that Netanyahu, someone who is extremely ruthless, someone who is extremely amoral, who is only really out to further his own personal political interests, he knows that he can effectively get away with anything. And not just because of the fact that he can manipulate political opinion in the United States, as he did when he visited and did that speech, but also because he has been shown repeatedly that the U.S. government will not, under Biden at least, will not cut off the flow of weapons that his government needs to not just wage war in Gaza, but to potentially expand this war to Lebanon and maybe Iran. And as long as he knows that that unconditional support is going to keep flowing, he is effectively free to do whatever he wants. He has the knowledge that he can be as risky as possible. And, you know, I saw today that Biden supposedly said in this phone call that he had with him that, you know, this was it. After this latest Iranian retaliation, that will be the end, that the U.S. will not bail out Israel anymore. You know, I'm glad to hear that Biden made that so bluntly to him in this phone call, finally. But the thing is, does Biden have the credibility anymore to make that kind of threat to Netanyahu? Because Biden has shown repeatedly that he lays down these red lines and then he folds them. I think words at this point are not enough. What has to happen, what has to be communicated clearly to the Israeli leadership is that they will not get U.S. support, material support anymore. And that means cutting off the flow of weapons. Israel has not been engaged in a war of self-defense for the last many months. It has been engaged in a war of total destruction of a basically helpless population. And the only way that I think you're going to stop Netanyahu from causing some kind of disaster is to really show him, you know what, we're done. We're not giving you operational support for this anymore.
Well, to go back to the ground on Gaza, when you're talking about these 5,000-pound bombs, 2,000-pound bombs, so much ammunition and the destruction that all of this has caused on the ground, Samer, the official numbers at this point are over 40,000 Palestinians have been killed. Nearly 90,000 have been injured. A recent Lancet report says the true death toll could reach more than 186,000 Palestinians. That number includes people buried under rubble and indirect deaths due to the destruction of health facilities and other public infrastructure. It's also so important to talk about all of the children that have been killed. There have been more amputees than any other horrific assault we've seen in our lifetimes. We've had doctors on the show who've been all around the globe seeing so much horror, and they say they've never seen the kind of horror and the gunshot wounds to the heads of children. I mean, it's so horrific. So Israel forced 500,000 people to leave Gaza City earlier this month. Another 400,000 were forced to leave Khan Yunis in the south. Almost 83% of the Gaza Strip is now under evacuation orders. Can you give us a sense of the situation on the ground? I mean, people have been displaced so many times at this point.
That's right, Rose. It occurred to me this morning, actually, that it was exactly 10 years ago that I myself was walking through the eastern Gaza town of Shajaiya in the middle of the 2014 Israeli assault on Gaza. And at that point, that entire region of Gaza had been essentially leveled by Israeli airstrikes. And I remember the sight of surviving civilians crawling through the rubble looking for whatever they could salvage by way of books and clothing and, in the case of children, toys, etc. But I also remember the scent of dead bodies everywhere. And this was, it's important to remember, this was a war in which something like 2,200 people were killed. And as you just mentioned, you know, what we know for sure is that 39,000 is the absolute baseline. And that number has not gone up significantly, despite the fact that we hear on a daily basis about dozens, if not hundreds, of people who have been massacred. So it's little wonder that when Ismail Al-Ghul posted himself on social media mere days before he was killed by the Israelis about not being able to tolerate anymore the sound of the screams beneath the rubble, that the Lancet would draw this conclusion, because it's quite likely that there are thousands upon thousands of people who have not been accounted for yet. Mm. And so I think you're right to point that out. The other piece of this is that, you know, I really want to remind your listeners that the number of times that we have on this program and others, you know, talked about a sense of hope coming out of a Security Council resolution, or the fact that Biden might have said something hinting at the possibility that the Americans at some point in the future might do something to withhold weapons for Israel. The number of times that this has happened to the people of Gaza, where they wake up in the morning and they think to themselves, okay, now maybe there will be a ceasefire. Now maybe we will have the opportunity to think about a future beyond, you know, the inevitable death of all of our loved ones or our displacement. With Haniyeh's killing, Haniyeh being the single individual within Hamas who is capable of brokering a ceasefire negotiation with Israel, there is no hope of that left. And I think the number one thing to remember right now about the situation of individual human beings in Gaza is that they harbor little to no hope that this will come to an end. Because when you look around the region and you think about the, you know, the political dynamics in a place like the United States, it's clear to them that the world has abandoned them. And I think that above all is the greatest tragedy of the last month. Those 500,000, you know, hundreds of thousands more people who have been displaced numerous times are doing so without any sense of where they're going and how they will land. And that is, to me, the greatest tragedy of all of this.
And the other thing, Samer, I think about a lot is, and I did not know this before this horrific assault, but the West Bank and Gaza has one of the highest literacy rates in the world. And to think that the overwhelming majority of the schools and the colleges have been completely decimated. The kids and young students are not, they have not been going to school for now 10 months.
Yes. Yeah, in fact, it was, we were talking earlier about the sources of information coming out of Gaza. And, you know, for my money, UNRWA, the UN Relief and Works Agency, which has been entirely defunded and demonized by our own U.S. government, remains the sole institution in Gaza that has the resources and the infrastructure to be able to report anything with any sense of clarity. And they're talking about 600,000 children. Who have not been in school for 10 months. And these 600,000 children, as we said, have no prospect of going back to school. But there are people who are trying, and this is the part that I think we need to, I do need to balance out a little bit of what I was saying earlier, which is that, you know, on a sort of mass level, it's easy to see where people would lose hope. But on an individual level, the human spirit somehow abides. And I think that, you know, is something that any of us who have been in these situations or talk to people who have been know that, you know, today, as we speak in these tents, and you know, we can't even call them camps anymore, but in these random allotments of people sitting in hastily erected tents throughout Gaza, there are teenagers who are teaching their young siblings how to do math. There are parents who are trying to convince their crying babies that they will have food, they will have security, that the bombs will not kill them. These kinds of things are ongoing. And ultimately, that is the hope that will take us forward, right, toward the future. It's what, you know, people like Oren, who you're speaking to in Israel, maintain the same thing. And it's that spirit that I think, you know, in the absence of any political prospects, we need to do a better job of listening to the folks who are continuing in, along those lines. And I think, you know, last thing to say about this, Rose, about the education situation right now in Gaza, is that, as you rightly pointed out, there isn't a single university left in the Gaza Strip. And, you know, the clear takeaway from all of this is that the Israelis have no intention of allowing Palestinians in Gaza to rebuild. And that's something we can not lose sight of. I think it's something that Branko made a good point of pointing out at the top of the segment as well.
Samer Badawi is a Palestinian writer and contributor to Plus 972, an independent magazine run by Palestinian and Israeli journalists. Branko Marchatich is Jacobin staff writer and author of the book Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. He wrote a piece called How Joe Biden Became a Steadfast Israel Defender. Let's spend a few minutes talking about the journalists. Again, international journalists, Oren is 2 hours from Gaza and he cannot get in. It's Palestinian journalists who have not had a break, who have been just really putting out videos and photographs day after day after day. More than 150 journalists have been killed in Gaza. On Tuesday, Al Jazeera Arabic correspondent Ismail Al-Ghul and his cameraman Rami Al-Rafi were killed in an Israeli air attack on their car in the west of Gaza City. The Al Jazeera Media Network has called their killings a, quote, cold-blooded assassination. Al Jazeera journalist Hind Khoudary has been reporting from Gaza for the past 10 months. On Wednesday, she reported on the deaths of her colleagues and talked about the measures they take to try to stay alive.
We do everything. We wear our press jackets. We wear our helmets. We try to not go to anywhere where it's not safe. We try to go to anywhere where to keep our security. But we have been targeted in normal places where normal citizens are. We're trying to do everything, but at the same time, we want to report. We want to tell the world what's going on. It's heartbreaking to report this today, and it's heartbreaking to report Shireen's killing, Hamza's killing, and Samir's killing. And this is not the first time we're doing this, but every time it feels as if it's the first time. It's a great loss for us here, journalists in Gaza, and especially Al Jazeera's team, losing such a colleague.
That's Al Jazeera journalist Hind Khoudary, who's been reporting from Gaza for the past 10 months. Here is Mohammed Moawad, Al Jazeera's managing editor.
This is a kind of a loop that the Israeli forces and government is going through with Al Jazeera. They're trying to conceal what's happening in northern Gaza. We've been trying every day in the morning to convince them to stop reporting from North Gaza and evacuate for the safety. But what we get from them is we are resilient. We're not going to leave this place. We're giving voice to the voiceless. And if we leave, who else is going to report?
And if you'd like to see that entire video, you can find it on our website, kalw.org. Click news and then your call. Unfortunately, we are almost out of time. We're going to do an entire show about the journalists in Gaza. But Bronco, two questions for you. We've got about 4 or 5 minutes left. Why hasn't this created more outrage from Western journalists, given what just happened and then the fact that more than 150 journalists have been killed and people cannot get in? That's the first question. And then if you can give us a thumbnail sketch of the piece that you wrote, how Joe Biden became a steadfast Israel defender.
Well, to answer your first question, I mean, I think it's a very good question that people should be asking. You know, we went through the Trump years correctly talking about the danger of going after journalists, targeting them, using hateful rhetoric. What we're seeing now is way beyond hateful rhetoric. It's way beyond someone being kicked out of press pool or being denied access to the president. It's journalists being killed. It's not just killed, but being targeted for assassination. It's their families being murdered. And again, I have to repeat, the number of reporters that have died in the scope of this war, it is unheard of for a single conflict. I mean, this is I think beyond every single reporter that was killed in any conflict of the last number of decades. So why is it that people don't care? I think, unfortunately, the Palestinian journalists, they do not, they are in Gaza and the West Bank. They do not hang out and get drinks and hobnob with the media here in the United States and other parts of the Western world, unfortunately. And a lot of the time, this is about who is in your social circle. But it really shouldn't be. We should be standing here on principle, and the fact that reporters are being murdered for doing their jobs should make us inherently outraged. To try and sum up my piece these last few minutes, my question was, what is it that is driving the decision-making behind this war? Because it seems so irrational, so self-destructive for Biden's own career, so self-destructive for the United States as well, if you consider U.S. interests. A lot of people have said, and Biden himself has said, this is something that started from when he was a young boy, that he had this connection to Israel. I looked at some of the archives, and that may be true. It may be true that his dad introduced this to him at the dinner table when he was a child. But what I also found was that it was a much more banal story of political ambition and the product of a lot of intense lobbying and advocacy work at the local and national level. There was a story that nearly derailed Biden's very first Senate campaign, where a campaign volunteer quit because he said that Biden had told him he wanted a position paper written for the Middle East and he couldn't put his real opinions about what should happen with Israel and Palestine because they would be, quote, political suicide. So he said, write me something and we want to get money from Jewish donors. So whatever position I'm going to take now for that purpose is the one that I will keep for the rest of my career. And, you know, that was one allegation, but it does fit with some of the archival records I was able to find, where you see Biden meeting with local pro-Israel advocacy groups. There's one set of notes about that meeting that talks about how Biden, who, you know, had taken a public stance of even after he'd won, of not getting involved in the Middle East too much, saying to these groups that he would, quote, change his principles to support military aid to Israel. You see him reporting back about meeting with Golda Meir on his first trip to Israel to a local pro-Israel advocacy group. And he says that, he agreed with Golda Meir that Israel needed to basically keep the territory he had conquered in 1967 and hold on to that, which of course is Gaza, West Bank, East Jerusalem, other territory, which is a pretty out of the mainstream position, certainly in the Democratic Party at the time and on international law. But if you're someone who is taking a position, a fairly new position out of political convenience, it's exactly the kind of maximalist position that you might take because you're not familiar with the issues, but you just want to appease the person that you're speaking to. And we see that throughout his career. You know, Biden was always taking positions that were even to the right of people like Ronald Reagan, very pro-Israel politicians, right-wing politicians. But Biden, I think, saw it as in his interest and in the interests of furthering his political ambitions, his career, as parroting the kind of most extreme hardline views of these groups, which, by the way, were not representative of all Jewish opinion. But Biden, I think, viewed them that way.
Branko Marchatich is Jacobin staff writer. You can find his piece, How Joe Biden Became a Steadfast Israel Defender, on our website, kalw.org. Click news and then your call. Samer Badawi is a Palestinian writer and contributor to +972. Branko and Samer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you
for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.